gotta get up.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your naked banjoist of music news.
Okay, now he was close. Tried to domesticate ya.
And possible plagiarism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. And that's Postmodern Jukebox with their version of Blurred Lines. I bet you're wondering.
Strong open.
I bet you're
strong
wondering open. Why. Why a bluegrass version? We'll get to that. This was the week of Blurred Lines, and the news story about the song Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke with Pharrell and T.I. being in the news. The gay family in a court ruling was awarded $7.4 million, is that right?
I think approximately, yeah.
Because of what were decided to be a copyright infractions. Ben Cesario wrote a series of news pieces about the trial. And John Caramonica, you wrote a critical take that came out on Wednesday. John, your critical take, if I understand it right, was an expression of frustration basically that our copyright system is based on written representation of songs, and that, you know, what we know as popular music now has so much stuff that cannot be adequately represented in standard notation that holds up in court.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, songwriting is protected in the sense of written representation of music, and sound recordings are protected, obviously. We have a whole sampling system premised upon protected sound recordings. But to me, so much of what's interesting or novel about contemporary music production are not things that can be adequately represented within current notation systems or within current written systems.
You said production. Did you mean production in the sense of music production?
As opposed to?
Well, do you mean production as opposed to songwriting? Or do you mean just music making?
We're already making. In the weeds
Oh
here.
My gosh. All of the above for these purposes. I mean production as a technique of creating a song, not production independent of writing.
But this is an important point because a song these days is not just a written melody, you know, and a set of chord changes.
No, it's funny. Just as a total sidebar, I was reviewing this documentary called The Wrecking Crew about all the 60s session musicians who like recorded basically all the big records of the 60s. Mm-hmm. And in there's like a round table amongst them. And they're all just like, yeah, they would give us these melodies, but like you can't write down what we would play. Like it's what we did to it. And I'm just like, oh, they were fighting over 50 years ago.
Sure.
But that's roughly when the copyright statutes, I mean, the copyright statutes go to the 70s, but the issues are very much the same. So when I think of sort of gestural things in pop music that stand out to me in current pop, they're not things that, broadly speaking, are protected by current copyright statutes.
Right.
And I'm not super in favor of copyright law being as oppressive as it maybe it could be. But what I do think is that if you're going to protect some forms of the creative process, you should at least go as far as to protect all the relevant forms, all the relevant aspects of the creative process.
Which could be...
Oh, it's a mess. No, I mean, maybe the final takeaway is, no, please don't do that.
Well, okay, so let's get to that a little later. But Ben Cesario, how did the gay family win? I mean, for instance, was it through getting the jury to understand exactly what in Marvin Gaye's song Got to Give It Up could be legally protected and showing that based on that info that the similarities were irrefutable?
By the letter of the law, yeah, that's what they were supposed to be doing.
Right.
Is that to prove copyright infringement, there's supposed to be what's called substantial similarity between the two pieces. And that was the instruction to the jury. Do you find these two pieces to be substantially similar?
Right.
Meaning not trivial, not a little bit similar, maybe not exactly the same, but close enough that it's a copy.
And it's the sheet music in this case that was substantial, the substantial similarity.
Well, sort of. It's also what the sheet music represents, because really the jury wasn't looking at two pieces of paper and saying, this piece of paper looks like that piece of paper, because the piece of paper itself is a representation of the musical notes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in fact, the jury, you know, they're not required to read music. And so at the trial, there was a whole system that had been sort of adopted by the lawyers to have music experts. There were musicologists.
Two of them.
Well, there were two on the Marvin Gaye's family side.
Right.
And then there was at least one on the other side, maybe two.
Okay.
And they each basically gave their versions of what is represented in the sheet music. Sheet music just sort of meaning the notes, the chords, the most fundamental kind of musical expression.
Were they allowed to hear the songs?
They were not allowed to hear Got to Give It Up.
That's what I understand.
But they did hear Blurred Lines. They did hear the commercial recording of Blurred Lines at the very end of the trial.
Why were they allowed to hear Blurred Lines?
I'm a little wary of answering this just because I feel like there might be a legalese side of it I'd get wrong.
Yeah.
But part of the reason that this was only the, quote, sheet music had to do with the way that songs are registered with the Copyright Office. When Got to Give It Up came out in 1977, according to the judge, you were not allowed to simply submit a recording and say, this is my songwriting, this is the record of it. You had to submit sheet music.
Right.
There's also the fact that Marvin Gaye's children, they only own a share of the publishing. They don't own the recording. That's owned by Motown. You know, by the letter of the law, the jury was just supposed to be listening to these two songs and making a decision. But one of the really interesting things about this case was what came out about the personalities and Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams and what they said and how they said under oath that they had been lying during interviews, that even though Robin Thicke has a songwriting credit on the song, he claimed later, I had nothing to do with it. I was drunk and high the whole time. I just showed up.
Mm-hmm. Which made it essentially Pharrell's problem.
Which made it Pharrell's problem, although he still owns part of the song and is liable for a lot of it.
It's his problem still.
But I think what it did is it really undermined their credibility as witnesses. And the lawyer representing Marvin Gaye's family really pounced on that. And that was a big part of his closing argument. It's basically, how can you believe these guys? How can you believe anything they say? They're these rich, fancy schmancy guys, and they're trying to get away with it.
Okay, so wait. What exactly undermined their credibility? The drunken high thing? The disagreement about who actually wrote the song? Or weird gaps in their knowledge about the technical aspects?
I don't think it's either of those. I think it's just the fact that they changed their story,
right?
You know, many times.
Right. Okay. Which is never a good thing.
And I think that like when you go to sort of eight ordinary people on a jury and you're told, oh, I've been lying to the news media. I gave all these numerous interviews in which I festooned praise on Marvin Gaye and said he's my idol and I wanted to emulate him. And then afterwards you say, oh, no, I was never thinking about it at all.
They think something's fishy.
You know, I just think if you're a member of a jury, that doesn't really sit very well with you.
And the jury presumably is made up of people who maybe have never heard of Robin Thicke, you know. Maybe that's the main thing, in fact. Possibly they've heard of Pharrell. I don't know. Maybe they've heard of Marvin Gaye but couldn't sing you one of his songs. They wouldn't also come in there thinking, you know, Marvin Gaye is a figure from the past of American music who is known to have suffered for his art, whereas these guys are sort of like happy-go-lucky opportunists. I mean, nobody probably was thinking along those lines.
No, but I think what Ben's getting at is these guys came off like smarmy D-bags.
And
a reasonable jury member who's like not super acquainted with them probably looked at them and was like, meh.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I have no idea what the jury thought about Marvin Gaye, but probably once they sat down and read his resume, they went, oh, yeah, him, you know, I know Marvin Gaye songs. He's famous. And I think in general, I mean, he's a beloved legendary musical figure in our culture, and he represents Motown. Mm-hmm. And his family is there every single day at the trial, and they look really serious, and they look like they want to protect their father and their legacy. And I think that means something to a jury. And Pharrell and Robin Thicke showed up a couple times, and by reports, you know, they were a little smirky in court. Their lawyer is a very experienced, insidery music business person who's a real smooth talker. And you know, I'm guessing here because I don't know what the jury based their decision on. But I think it is possible that there was a little bit of a culture clash there about how the two sides appeared and about you know, the usual things that a jury considers in a trial, that, not necessarily about musicology, but just, you know, who do I believe here?
And to jump on one thing, you know, this word keeps coming up over and over again, which is jury. This is a jury decision.
Right. It was not a judge.
Not a judge. This is a jury decision. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys read Keith Harris's piece that came out the day after the decision. Keith Harris, who's a music writer but also a lawyer, just made a very, I thought, very simple, straightforward point, which is after this verdict, how hard are people going to try to not send these cases to juries? You want to keep this out of it because a jury is unpredictable. This could have gone either way, but it went in this very in a way that's been damaging. I think a lot of people, friends of mine in the music industry, reach out to me and say they're so stressed. They work at labels. They're worried it's going to open the door for it's a Pandora's box of potential lawsuits. They're stressed. And juries are capricious. So I think what you may see a lot of sort of copycat suits, for lack of a better words, you also are going to see a lot of people trying to settle just to avoid this jury problem, because you just don't know what you're going to have, what you're going to get with that. Mm-hmm.
Well, before we go any further, why don't we hear just one after the other, a little snippet of both songs?
Are there black metal versions available that we can play?
There may be.
There may be. Okay, we'll dig. Everybody get up.
So Ben Cesario, I want you to sort of be half in and half out of your role, or deal with this question however you want. Totally up to you. What was your reaction to the verdict? What did you think about the verdict?
I was surprised by it. Mm-hmm. I thought that Marvin Gaye's side was really handicapped by the way that the trial was set up about the sheet music thing. That specifically came out of a judge's ruling. And there's also a long history here where it's very, very hard to win copyright infringement suits like this. Going back decades, very few have succeeded.
Why is it so hard?
Well, it's just a hard thing to prove, and there's not like a letter of the law that says if X, Y, and Z happens, then it is copyright infringement. There's just this principle of substantial similarity. There's a couple other related ideas there, but it's not this. It's not as simple as saying, you know, was there a suitcase full of money that somebody, you know, escaped with? Okay, they stole it. It's a judgment call that has to be made by a jury, and there's a lot of ways for defendants to sort of chip away at this.
And it's more difficult even than, say, sampling, where, you know, that comes down to
it's pretty
how
clear.
Many bars, how many seconds of music, whatever.
And but also, like, was the sample used, yes or no? It's pretty easy to determine that. You know, just on the basis of kind of like probability and odds, you know, it was a long shot. And, you know, the trial was back and forth, but the lawyer who represented the Gaye family has a pretty strong record of doing some of these things. He's a guy named Richard Bush, and he's represented a lot of cases of artists kind of going after long shots for their rights, and he's won a lot of them. I mean, I didn't think it was no chance, but just generally, I was surprised by it. I thought the damages award was high, you know, $7 million.
Weren't they asking for more?
They were asking for more, but as kind of a Hail Mary.
Okay.
Where, like, you basically, like, add up every penny that you can possibly say this song earned and say that's how much we want.
Gotcha.
But part of the principle is sort of like, you know, if it had been licensed in the usual way, then they would have gotten about half of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they took half of what they estimated the publishing eventually was, and they got to $4 million. Mm-hmm. And the rest was considered profits.
Oh, okay.
But of course, if they had licensed this song years ago, maybe they could have done it for a flat fee. You know,
yeah.
Like maybe they could have settled this a year and a half ago for a tenth as much money.
It's also worth noting, like, obviously, look, a record label has like a vested interest in and a musician has vested interest in not being dragged through litigation of this.
Yeah.
oftentimes problems like this are obviously resolved before songs are ever released, or sometimes a song just gets out in the world and then there's some backroom conversation and people very quietly kind of do the adjusting and they do them, they fix it. You know, basically like the Sam Smith, Tom Petty thing, mm-hmm. although that became public. But stuff like that happens,
all
the
a lot.
Time. Yeah, it happens all the time. This is not a remarkable case on its merits.
Right.
It's not a remarkable case.
Right.
It's remarkable that it ended up in a court of law. It's remarkable that it ended up with that dollar amount. But on its merits, it's not that interesting. And I feel like you started to see some comparison yesterday, well, really in conversation for the past couple of weeks, comparing it to the Bismarcky sampling case about like, oh, it's this huge precedent and da-da-da. To me, it doesn't feel like that. The Bismarcky case was like a very cut and dry. It's like you use it, you got to pay for it.
Right.
And if we catch you, we can pull your thing off the shelf.
Sure.
Very straightforward. This feels much, much looser.
It's kind of the oldest story, you know, there is about like you stole my song, you stole my screenplay, you stole my book idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those have not really ever hindered new screenplays to be written and so forth. When this case sort of first came out and when it was clear it was going to trial, I polled a lot of lawyers about this and I mm-hmm. talked to a lot of people. And the response I generally got was, this is kind of a run-of-the-mill copyright infringement case.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But there was always this hesitation of like, well, until it becomes something else, and that there's always the chance that either because of the ultimate verdict or the size of the damages or the way the jury
– The fame of the participants.
Yeah. Like it can have far-reaching effects. They may not be legally precedent, you know, but it can really affect the way like the business operates, and maybe in the back of their mind a musician will be thinking like, uh-oh. Maybe this
more,
is a little too
more vigilant.
Well,
they'll be more upfront.
It's possible.
But that leads me to a question I wanted to ask you, Ben. Pharrell and Robin Thicke filed a preemptive suit against the gay family in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
What prompted that?
They had been threatened by Marvin Gaye's family.
The gay family came to them in a preliminary way and said, look, it's clear that there's similarity and we're talking to our lawyers.
As John said, it's a pretty common thing that, you know, somebody comes out of the woodwork and say, your song rips off my song.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What are we going to do about this?
I guess to me the shocking thing is at that moment, instead of just being like, we'll throw you 5%.
Well, which is what usually happens.
And that's what usually happens. And frankly, it's not as if Pharrell is somehow a guy who has never worked with other people's melody. I mean,
but
it's 5%, not.
5%. I mean, if you think that the song is original, it's your song, why would you want to give up 5%? And why would you want somebody else's name on the song? If you believe that it's original, then why would you settle?
Well, I mean, I guess the question becomes, does he believe it's original or does he believe that he would never have to admit it wasn't original?
Right. And the funny thing is, if you are certain that it's original, then that means you're certain about how you wrote it and what is the technical difference between your song and other song.
Do you know a story you'd like to share?
Well, I do.
All right.
I'll get to it. The Robin Thicke deposition is a masterpiece.
It's great.
He comes off.
I'm getting a tattoo of it. It's phenomenal.
You know, it's possible even that he created this persona because this persona is a perfect buffoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I think he's telling the truth 100%.
Oh, no. Who knows?
But I love that this is a thing that he's on the record saying.
He's boorish and underinformed, very self-loving. Did you check out that point where he listened to his voice in the playback and he's like, man, I got to quit smoking. That voice, that is a brilliant voice. Amazing.
They should have deposed his ex.
They may have because she actually was a party in the case.
Mm. Was she?
Because there was a secondary claim that Robin Thicke had ripped off yet another Marvin Gaye song.
A different song.
Yeah, a different Marvin Gaye song, a different Robin Thicke song, uh-huh. And Paula Patton has a songwriting credit on that song.
Yo.
And so.
Yo, where are them transcripts at, Ben Cesario?
Let's get them. Good question.
Oh,
well,
my God.
The other thing that came out in Pharrell's deposition is, you know, they're grilling Pharrell on, at the point of creation of this song, what went into it? What were you thinking about? You know, apparently Robin Thicke has given an interview where he said that you were both talking about the song Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye, and then you started like kind of using that song as a basis. Is that what happened? And he said, no. That's not the way I remember it. What I remember is that we were in the studio and I was running back and forth between different sessions and Miley Cyrus was doing a session down the hall and I had just been in that studio and I was thinking, you know, country music, Miley Cyrus, whatever. And he's and then he said, you know, I want to get bluegrass vocal harmonies on this Robin Thicke record. Bluegrass. Mm-hmm. So he's like, no, it's not about Marvin Gaye. It's about bluegrass, which adds a funny curve to this story, making it not necessarily a clear-cut case of the white man ripping off the black man mm-hmm. to create a sort of fake black music or something, you know?
That's if you buy that story.
Sure.
I mean, this was a deposition given under oath, so mm-hmm. you have to think it's probably the truth, but not necessarily. And like, you know, it's just one more version of this origin story.
Also, are we going to do the line from like slave spirituals to certain music into bluegrass? Like, are we going to do that line?
We could. So. But I'll tell you what, the thing that makes me think that Pharrell was being honest when he said that is that in the Blurred Lines video, there's a naked woman holding a banjo.
Yeah, oh, I thought it was goats too.
I thought it was because he had like a Dalian Vincent album.
Oh,
like,
right.
When he came into court, he was just like, here, everybody gets a copy of this.
Apart from the sort of legal question of what exactly happened here and, you know, where do the lines point about who did what, I mean, a lot of this case did really bring up interesting questions about music and about how it's created and what people are thinking of, what their intentions are.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's be amateur musicologists. Because we can listen, forget about what we can see, you know, written on paper. I don't want to think about that. Because we can listen, what are the parts of the songs that have the most similarity?
A segment of the bass line is, if not identical, very close.
And the phrasing of it.
It's not the whole thing. It's,
no.
It's a bit. It's, yep. it's a part of it that's repeated.
Right.
I also think, broadly speaking, the sort of ecstatic vibe of the chorus,
mm-hmm.
it's similar. It's not the same melody, but it does feel like it feels like it's playing in the same stadium
right.
as the Marvin Gaye song.
Right.
But it's not the same melody.
And maybe the cowbell.
Yes.
It's funny. Also, another interesting thing from Pharrell's deposition, he talks about milk bottle records. What he calls milk bottle records from the 80s, that there were lots of them,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So I didn't know what he was talking about.
He's saying what's so special about that. Just to get back to the question, this does happen a lot, you know? And as you said in your article, John, there are various ways now of giving credit. Sometimes, you know, interpolates a section
yeah, that's,
of
or that was
based
sort of interesting,
on or something.
What I would have expected in a case like this is when the Gaye family starts poking at Thicke and Pharrell.
They change the credit.
They add the credit. You give them your whatever it is, whether you think it's real or not. You give them your 3, 5, 10%.
Sure.
Say it contains an interpolation of Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody goes home a little bit richer.
And in some cases, it's maybe more nebulous. I'm thinking of the song Rocket by Beyoncé where, I mean, what's the first thing you think of when you hear it? There's only one thing you think of, and that's D'Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe even the one song by D'Angelo, Untitled.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way the bass sounds, because of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same song, but because of the feeling and the atmosphere, you only think of one person.
But
D'Angelo doesn't have a writing credit, and it's not based
it's not
on a whatever.
Right, and copyright law doesn't protect. Whatever it is you're identifying
right.
is not protected by copyright law.
In that case,
and this is why I wrote the piece that I wrote, because I wanted to suggest that music creation has evolved to the point where there are aspects of music creation that are signature and that are theoretically protectable, but that are not currently accounted for by the current setup.
That was a fascinating piece, and I just feel like I want to put the other side out there just to give it airtime.
Uh-huh.
That the things that John is talking about, they're sometimes seen as style or technique, and that there's a view that these definitely should not be copyrightable because these are their gesture. They're the sort of things that are, you know, are meant to be imitated in some ways. That the Beatles had mop tops and played guitar in a certain way, and there's a certain sound to the vocals, and part of it has to do with their sound, what their producer did, the technology of the time,
mm-hmm.
and that part of what pop music does is rip off style and, you know,
sure.
and gesture and tone and those kind of things. And
sometimes in the heat of the moment.
If that was copyrightable, then that would have a very interesting effect on music history. I mean that
oh,
you know,
absolutely. And I'm not even necessarily
does the GarageBand have to say it contains an interpolation of the Beatles because we kind of sound like the Beatles?
But it's sort of fascinating because like you know, look at, say, the Sam Smith, Tom Petty situation. Like, I understand the similarities between the choruses of those two songs, but, like, to me, that the Smith song does not necessarily owe a traditional debt to the Tom Petty song. Tom Petty may have gotten to the, but, like, if we start digging,
yeah.
I'm sure he got it from somebody, and I'm sure that person got it from somebody.
Right.
So I totally understand, but I think what I was trying to articulate, and it's a very nebulous thing. Yes, it is technique. It is gestural. But in contemporary popular music, sometimes the gestures are the signature things and are the things that were not necessarily in the 50s or 60s, people were not worried about protecting, but maybe should be worried about if we're going to protect.
I don't know.
I'm generally anti-copyright, or broadly speaking.
But, John Caramonica, example.
Oh, the Iggy and Mustard.
Tell us.
So, okay. So, you know, Iggy Azalea, they've been trying to make Iggy Azalea happen for a long time. But when Fancy came out, it came out in a very loud way, and it came out and I think hit very quickly, in part because it sounded very similar to what rap radio had sounded like for, say, the previous 12 to 18 months. And what that was the DJ Mustard sound. Mustard has, like, a pretty signature, the tone and shape of his synth lines or bass lines, whatever, you know, whatever he's using. They're pretty signature. They're crisp. They have, like, a belly to them, but they're crisp. They're bouncy. And the tone is very particular. The people who produced that Iggy Azalea record basically just took it. And you can't identify the melody, like the way the cadence, the pacing of it. It's not something that's pulled from a specific Mustard record, but it is very much meant to be confused. It's purposefully confusing. There's no Mustard on the beat, ho. Like there's no vocal stamp ID, but it's meant to be confusing because it's meant to fit in with all this other stuff. I don't think under current copyright law, might be wrong, but best I can tell, Mustard has no actual protection for any of that stuff unless they are taking literally a sound sample that he has put in the world and then using it on their record.
Sure.
He has no recourse. That to me seems like a far more egregious thing that we should all be if we're trying to fight this stuff, that's a really egregious case that should be fought as compared to the Pharrell and Marvin Gaye, the Thicke and Marvin Gaye situation, which seems incidental at best.
If I could just add an asterisk here.
Please.
I do think there is one more little piece of this, which is sometimes called moral rights, which is basically like the right of identity.
Mm-hmm.
That like if somebody has such a distinctive voice and manner, like Tom Waits, like they can sue if they've been ripped off.
That happens with commercials,
it's
I feel, sometimes.
It's happened with commercials, but I mean it's still a copyright issue.
It happened with Tom Waits. Right?
It has happened with Tom Waits, and he has protected that more than once. So yes, the like sound production stuff is not copyrighted.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you're talking about singers and voices and personalities and like distinctive ways that people represent themselves in media, there actually is a little bit of protection there.
So then maybe we should all – who's a lawyer who can protect DJ Mustard's moral rights?
1-800-NYT-POPCAST.
John Caramonica and Ben Cesario, I just want to wrap this up by asking you, what have we learned from – this whole story and spectacle?
I learned that this stuff is really confusing, but it's still a hugely important part of the music business. Kind of no matter what side you're on, there's pros and cons about it, and there's going to be some kinds of impact on the music industry, I think.
I learned not to trust a jury over my own ear.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have dueling experts in this case, and everybody people with a refined ear can disagree, and people with a less refined ear can disagree. But there's nothing satisfying about this ruling coming from a jury with the particular set of strictures that they had to work within and with this dollar amount as the outcome. There's nothing satisfying unless you are the recipient of the $7.4 million. No one should be satisfied. And almost everybody I know is disappointed. Even if they agree with the verdict, they're frustrated.
And I think that actually your point got to the heart of some of the things that, you know, that I've been thinking, which is that the copyrightable material of any piece of music is sometimes
extra musical.
Is sometimes not the most important. And, well, you mentioned that the problem with this case is that it favors the way music was made at an earlier time as opposed to now.
It's premised upon it and therefore implicitly favors it.
Right.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I guess one has to maybe note here that I think Marvin Gaye didn't read or write music.
No, and if I'm not mistaken, that that song was, I may be wrong, but I think that song was composed and then back sheet musicked,
yeah,
like retroactively.
But anyway, if we're talking about music, music, like this thing that's been around since the first time anybody made a bone flute or whatever, or sang a song, sang a song of victory or of,
wasn't,
you know,
the drum the first instrument?
Something like that.
According to kindergarten.
Yes. That whole thing versus the period of time in which, you know, music has been notated according to standard, mm-hmm, Western notation, and then there's been a system of law to protect that.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's worth mentioning that, like, we may all be sitting here 10 years from now with a different case, because there are people who are working to notate hip-hop production, who are working to notate all the gestural things that we think are not currently notatable, or at least aren't reflected in current notation systems. People are working on that, whether they'll be widely accepted, whether it'll, I mean, who knows? You can always rely on, like, the systems of power to try to absorb the things that operate outside the systems of power. So producers and songwriters who are working outside of the traditional, the old school method of creating music, the people who are invested in copyright, in licensing and those things, they want to find ways to make money off that. They will find ways to notate it, and they will find ways to profit off of it. Mm. We're in that weird middle ground right now where some of the stuff makes sense, but the current stuff doesn't make sense in the old system.
And let's go out with something you referenced in your piece, John. A DJ Mustard production by 2 Chainz.
If you look at Fancy, you listen to Fancy, there's not a one-to-one relationship between Fancy's sort of bouncy synth lines and a specific DJ Mustard song. But if you were to listen to Fancy and 5 DJ Mustard songs back to back, you may not be able to tell which one was the non-DJ Mustard track. I just do want to add, though, that, like, nothing I say should be taken seriously, because I'm just super high on alcohol and Vicodin, alcohol and Vicodin right now. So, well, so it's just a wash.
I've enjoyed your deposition.
Thank you.
Both of you, John Caramonica, Ben Cesario, thank you for coming.
First things first, I'm the realest. Drop this and let the whole world feel it.
Let them feel it.
And I'm still in the murder business. I can hold you down like I'm giving lessons in physics.
Right, right.
You should want a bad dude like this.
Huh?
Drop it low and pick it up just like this.
Yeah.
Cup of Ace, cup of Goose, cup of Chris. I heal some.
Pulling up to the scene with my ceiling missing. Middle finger up to my competition. I'm different, yeah, I'm different. I'm different, yeah, I'm different. I'm different, yeah, I'm different.
That's our show, and thank you for listening. And we want to thank our producers, Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can read our coverage of the Blurred Lines trial, both by John Caramonica and Ben Cesario, at nytimes.com/music, and listen to our Spotify playlist for lots of songs that have to do with these difficult issues.
Lots of songs that steal from each other.
Yeah. See you next week.
And me and you are cut from a different fabric. I feel so good, it's a bad